Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is Now or Never, and That Debt is Fraud, and we have Tammy back with us. Welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And we don't have Sean with us because of some complications. It's not because of a hurricane hitting Louisiana. More importantly, I talk about Learn, Pray, Act, and I go through the focus on the Constitution. I have had several conversations recently with a lot of, I'll just say, groups or group leaders in several different states, and it just seems like the frustration level is really high because, and it's not going to get any better. I mean, we can't allow the current misdirections to occupy what we need to do. In other words, we can't allow those things to get the best of us because we are constantly struggling with groups, organizational leaders that are obviating and taking us in the wrong directions. There are so many different, I mean, there are the people who, and we talk about the state nationalists and how they are state national sovereign citizen, jural assemblies, all of these people who are taking the direction that we need to abandon this constitutional government, we need to abandon our constitution, not pay taxes, go down these separate paths. And so everybody is trying to split the atom on how they're doing it a little bit differently. But bottom line, what they're doing is they're taking, and this is one of the reasons why, nobody's stopping them. Nobody's going after them for violating the laws or anything else. And actually, all that does is it buoys these arguments that, oh, look, we can get away with this. This is legitimate. What we're doing is legitimate. The reason this is all being tolerated is because they're helping get Americans, good patriots, out of the system. In other words, folks, all these people are no longer as U.S. citizens, and or because they're setting up what we call shadow governments, they are basically vulnerable. They can't vote. If they do vote, they can be basically thrown in jail. The only reason they're being tolerated, again, is because they're succeeding in taking away good patriots. Bottom line, what we need is we need all hands on deck. We need all hands on deck in doing the one thing that all citizens are required to do, to support the Constitution. Now, on the other side, within the rest of the conservative ranks, we have lots of people that are so steeped in the party and the politics that all they care about is their vengeance. All they care about is taking this unconstitutional government in the direction that they want it to go. In other words, they're not working to solve the problem. They're working to make sure the problem goes in their direction so they get more golden eggs out of the goose. And so, I'm not sure. Does that make sense, Tammy?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Because I think bottom line, when we really look at the problem is getting everybody rich. If you are in the problem for benefiting one direction, or in other words, if you're in it for political purposes, if you're in it like we are, trying to restore our government, then that's what we have to focus on. And the only way to get there is we have to demand that all these people in office, from your county up, they all need to start complying to the Constitution. So with that, we're in the 14th Amendment, and actually we were just wrapping up on Section 1. Is there any go back that you have on section?
Sorry, you cut out. Which section are we on?
Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. So is there any go backs that you have? Because what we did, what we covered, was we covered the citizen part. We covered the the protection of all citizens from losing or having their privileges and immunities abridged by any government, period. No government can create or enforce any law that basically takes away your privileges and immunities. Nor can any government deprive you of anything other than the due process. And I pointed out how that's just redundant, because that's already a privilege and immunity that is provided in the original Bill of Rights. But more importantly, the final clause is the equal protection of the laws. And so any questions on any of that before we move forward?
I think it's just really important to talk about, keep talking about what it means to be, what the jurisdiction meaning means, because people are being taught that just because illegal immigrants are inside the United States, they're under the jurisdiction of the United States.
That's not true. So the jurisdiction the jurisdiction of the individual is the nation where they are a citizen of. The only way your jurisdiction changes is when your citizenship changes. Even though the physical jurisdiction of all government goes to their boundaries. In other words, the way the Supreme Court has framed jurisdiction applies to anybody and everybody, which means then it applies beyond the boundaries of the United States. And they're saying, oh, well, we still have this magical line, but if we can actually wipe out the citizenship of anybody who crosses our border, then we've done that the same, you know, as they go back and so forth. So bottom line, why are we having these arbitrary lines? The Supreme Court, when they attacked the arbitrary lines, they weren't arbitrary. They called them arbitrary. The county lines were arbitrary. And I look at the way they're playing with jurisdiction as the borders of all nations are arbitrary. And in other words, the Supreme Court has gone so far out on a limb, and this was the very progressive Supreme Court. The current Supreme Court has never really addressed this. But to be clear, the only way the jurisdiction of a person, what government has jurisdiction over them, is determined by their citizenship. They actually have to obtain citizenship of the United States to become a citizen and to fall under its jurisdiction under those parameters of rights, privileges, and so forth. Now, you may be hear the old saying of when in Rome, do as the Romans do, because we don't have to let you stay here. You don't have a right to due process. If you get caught speeding and you are here as a non-citizen, then we could just deport you instead of doing anything. If you can't abide by our speed laws or traffic laws, then you're gone. It could be that simple. It is that simple. The Supreme Court has tried to cloud this issue because their objective is to allow the overrunning of our Constitution by extending citizenship to people who are not citizens, to the privileges and immunities of citizenship to people who are not citizens. And this is where this goes back down to how did the Supreme Court take on and obtain this type of power? It's clearly not in the Constitution. We've covered all of this. And so when I get that article done, when I actually finish the article that covers, you know, the poisonous pill of the Federalist Papers, how they literally were the elixir that gave the Supreme Court the illusion, because it's not real. The wording in the Federalist Papers made it seem like they have these powers. because of what Hamilton stated. And Hamilton was lying, and actually, it's clear, when we went through the ratification debates, the Supreme Court was limited and defined. They were a passive system. They couldn't make law. They couldn't interpret the law. None of the, they couldn't use case law and precedents to twist and bend the law. And yet they do today because of Hamilton and those Federalist Papers. So with that, let's go ahead and dive into Section 2, unless there's any more clarity. But folks, remember, the jurisdiction of an individual is based upon their citizenship. So when a child is born to non-citizens, we do not have an inhuman law that rips that child away from their parents. The child will always assume the citizenship of their parents. It's inhumane to say any child that's born here to non-citizens becomes our citizens and we have to kick these other people out, and that means that the state takes control of the child. No way. That's inhumane.
I never thought of it that way. That's a good point.
And that's one of the reasons why they, oh, well, you've had a child here. Now we have to fast track you because you have to become a citizen. Because that baby has become an anchor, and it would be inhumane for us to kick you out. See, they've done everything they can to make it so that we can be overrun by invaders. And this is why they use the term invader, not illegal status, somebody here that snuck in. No, they're just, I mean, nobody even wants to use the word trespass. They're trespassing, which means that they are violating a law. Because if by making it immigrant or they're migrating, then, oh, well, you know, they just wandered. Yeah. Folks, the nuances, the way they are playing with the language should infuriate you. It infuriates me. And to the fact that we have over 50 million invaders in America, that's only the ones that came in via the southern border, you know, those who actually overran our laws. That's only counting them. But technically, when you look at the federal government and their importation of persons, such as these refugees, every refugee has been brought here without the constitutional authority of the Constitution. The federal government does not have any authority within that Constitution to bring people in here as refugees. They were given the power to regulate states from being able to do that. That was it. And that happened in 1808, and it's in Article 1, Section 9, that as of that point, they can regulate the state's ability to for the importation of persons. It didn't grant them the ability to import anybody. So this is why, you know, everybody looks at me with real caution because they don't want me to tell you that immigration is a power and authority that's only granted to the states. The fact is the states basically abdicated this authority and allowed the federal government to assume authority over this. This is and this every time we give the federal government authority to do something, they end up using it as a weapon against us. Enough. Enough. So anyway, let's dive into Section 2. Now, this is the first time that they talk about apportionment in any way other than the amendment that Madison proposed in adjusting the apportionment. This is now this newfounded apportionment of people who just became citizens. Again, let's look up. And in Article or Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, all of a sudden, a whole bunch of people just became citizens. All of the slaves, the freemen, who were no longer slaves, the freemen, now became citizens. And they needed their apportionment so that they would have full apportionment. The three-fifths rule was gone. And, oh, by the way, we've got all these Native Americans or Indians who are in these states who became citizens as well. And now there needs to be an apportionment for all people who were subject to the jurisdiction of the United States while they were residing in these territories and states, they're now citizens. And therefore, they need to adjust the apportionment. That's what Section 2 does. This actually goes to help understand that the whole point of this line, and I want you to understand this, Tammy, the whole point of that very first line, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States where they reside. The whole point of this second section just proves that the intent was not to subjugate all people, but those people who now became or became qualified citizens. And the reason, and I said this before, the reason that they needed to become qualified citizens is because the Supreme Court assumed they could create a law that says blacks could not become citizens. And so, I have to silence that call. I'm sorry. That's somebody that's desperately probably trying to get a hold of me. Anyway. So, the whole point, again, is that they were trying to fix these problems from the Supreme Court and everybody else, because in the Dred Scott ruling, Taney basically made the assertion that blacks could not be citizens, and that became the law. And so they had to fix that. So they made it so that these people were now citizens, and now that they are, they're going to get full apportionment. And so that's what Section 2 is all about. So go ahead and dive into Section 2, and let's just go ahead and read this whole thing, because I want you to pay note to how they want to make sure that if the state starts playing any shenanigans by not allowing these citizens to vote, then they're going to lose apportionment.
Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, including Indians not taxed. But when the right to vote at any election for the choice of electors for president and vice president of the United States, representatives in Congress, the executive and judicial officers of a state, or the members of the legislature thereof, is denied to any of the male inhabitants of such state, being 21 years of age and citizens of the United States, or in any way abridged, except for participation in rebellion or other crime, the basis of representation therein shall be reduced in the proportion which the number of such male citizens shall bear to the whole number of male citizens 21 years of age in such state.
Okay, so does that make sense? In other words, what they basically just laid out was that now that all of these citizens, all these people that have been residing in your state are now actually bona fide citizens, you need to go through and reapportion your districts, your congressional districts and so forth, to ensure, it's kind of like at this point in time, you need to lay out what your congressional districts are going to be, because in just 2 years, we're going to have a census. And actually in 4 years, because actually, no, 2 years, because the Constitution was amended technically in 68. The amendment went out in 66, but it was fully amended in 68. And so in the next 2 years, they had to do redistricting. And so to make sure that everybody was properly accounted so that they knew what the numbers were for the districts and to prepare them for redistricting. If by chance they had, because the federal government, who conducts the census? The federal government does. And so they know when they come out and conduct the census, if there is all of these male citizens, and there's only so many registered voters, then the federal government is going to take, for every pound of flesh, or every person, they're going to take the same amount of pound of flesh out of apportionment. In other words, they're tying apportionment directly to who you allow to vote. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so if they try to play any shenanigans and say, yeah, you're a citizen, but we're not allowing you to vote, then all of a sudden they lose representation. And the last thing that the southern states want to do is not have their proper voice in the House of Representatives. I mean, they'll always maintain their equal suffrage in the Senate, but having the proper, you know, voice or the proper representation has always been important. Anyways, so Section 3, to me, is probably the diamond of the Constitution. If there's any one part, you know, so there are these groups out there that are telling you that the most important part of the Constitution is the Second Amendment, and or your freedom of religion, and or your freedom of the press, your freedom of speech, your freedom of expression, you know, your freedom from, you know, search and seizure without a warrant and without true probable cause. You know, all of those are good, good privileges and immunities, but the most important is our ability and our responsibility in holding public servants accountable, which Section 3 is the teeth in the Constitution. This is why this is the diamond. If anybody wanted to ask me what is the most important, and I'll probably maybe ask somebody down the road, you know, some other time of the year, what is the most important part of the Constitution to you? Hint, hint, hint. So, to me, you can't justify anything that's more important than holding our public servants accountable to their oath.
Yeah.
When you start this, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to, no person shall, I'm going to look that word, that string of words up, and I think there are seven matches to this. And the first time that it comes up, the first time we see no person shall is in Article 1, Section 2. And this is how it goes. No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state in which he shall be chosen. What that right there is the language of a standard for a person to be in office as a House of Representatives. Got it? The next time we hear this, no person shall, is in Article 1, Section 3. And it basically states that no person shall be a senator who shall have not attained the age of 30 years and had been 9 years a citizen. See, I kind of boggled that up last time I quoted off the top of my head. I think I said 35 years and 10 years citizen. But no, it said been 9 years citizen. And so, but bottom line, here's another instance of using the language that no person shall as a standard for a senator. So they had the standard for a representative. They had a standard for a senator. And so when we look at the next time, we look at no person shall, that is no person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony. So in other words, it's a standard for getting a conviction of a person for treason. So as we follow the layout, when we look at the Fifth Amendment, no person shall be held to answer for a crime. In other words, here's another standard regarding a criminal prosecution against a person. You cannot be standing in a trial without an indictment by a grand jury. So they use this language very specifically as a hardcore standard. Does that make sense? So the next time we see this is in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Now, if you read this, and I'm going to let you read this the way it goes, and we're actually going to go into break in just a second. So when we come back, I'll let you read this. But when you're done reading this, I'm going to dissect this. I'm going to break this down into the four or five parts that it is, so that everybody can look at it and go, oh my gosh, the way they made this run-on language in this, it made it difficult for people to dissect. It's really not that hard. You just have to you just have to use, you know, a little bit of ruling, but we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what we're going to do is, Tammy, I'm going to let you go ahead and read this freely, and I'll let you go ahead and just read the entire language of this. And, folks, I want you to kind of listen because it's going to be cumbersome for you to understand. And that's because they do two different qualifications of who this is applying to, which kind of makes it a little confusing. And what they could have done was actually just simplified that little language, or the language of these two stanzas of qualifiers. So go ahead and read it, and then I'm going to dissect this. Go ahead.
Okay. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States, or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress, or as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, but Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each House, remove such disability.
Okay, so there are two parts of this that kind of create the qualifications or who this is applying to, which confuses everything. So it starts off with no person shall be. That's pretty simple. As far as I'm concerned, everybody understands that this now, when by using that language, they are creating a standard in the Constitution regarding people in office. Then they list out the types of people that this qualifies to. And actually, they do this twice. And so they do this as shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector. So they're talking about the Electoral College. You can't be a member of the Electoral College for choosing the president or vice president, or hold any office. Folks, I'm hoping you're reading along, or when you get home, you open and listen to this podcast, listen to this show we're broadcasting, and actually read these words that I'm going through this, because by doing this, this actually clears the fog. So in other words, you can't be a representative, you can't be a senator or an elector in the Electoral College, or hold any office, civil or military. You hear that? Military. You can't be in civil office or even in the military under the United States. In other words, you can't be a member of the state militia or under any state. And so what they're basically saying is, and to really help clarify this, no person shall, this is what the language really should have been. No person shall be a office holder in any capacity, federal, state, or local, who is placed under oath to support this Constitution, who have previously taken an oath. And then you could just get rid of this last part, because I just covered everything in the very first part of the who this qualifies to, because then they go through another iteration. So who have previously taken an oath as a member of Congress, as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature. In other words, they're just, again, listing So this whole line, this whole stanza can go away. Just delete it. And then it would go, who having previously taken an oath to support the Constitution of the United States, and then you have to insert, who have or shall engage in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. Done. In other words, you can't be in office if you've been put under oath to support the Constitution and you have actually failed by getting engaged in a rebellion against the Constitution, or have given aid and comfort to those enemies, those people who are attacking the Constitution. You're gone. In other words, you can't be in office. Notice that there's no line in here, none, that says you are to be tried for this or tried for that. If it is proven, and so the requirement for every house and every chamber, the Senate, the House of Representatives, and every state legislature, every county commissioners or supervisors, whatever you call them, whatever the different offices are, they have to create a mechanism of saying, what is that hard evidence that we need that will now disqualify and make the person permanently ineligible to ever hold an office? Because this last line tells you the ramifications of the removal of these people. But Congress, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, removes such disability. In other words, this is not really taking a person's property. This isn't taking their life. It isn't taking their liberty away. This is why due process is not being granted. They are being removed and permanently banned. They're now been disabled to ever hold public office again. So that final line kind of literally lets you understand these people have been so bad we can never trust them ever again unless 2/3 of each House of Congress removes the disability. Therefore, every legislative body has to set up and has to amend their constitution to rectify anything when it comes to a person being removed. They're not to be impeached. They're to be removed. When a person has, you know, behaved badly because they're violating their oath of office, not just because, you know, drunk and disorderly, those other processes, impeachment, those types of things still stand. You violate your oath, it is done. I mean, bing! You know, the register has, you know, the capturing of the moment has been made. You voted for a bill that directly violated the Constitution. Digital currency bill is a perfect example. If you're a legislator, state legislator, who voted for the digital currency bill, and we have a whole bunch of them in the state of Washington who should be banned and disqualified based on the supreme law of the land. So, folks, I want you to understand that this would get rid of probably almost everybody in office. Absolutely. And I believe that the implementation, because we've never done this, we've never held people accountable, and because they've constantly hidden under this shroud of honor among thieves paradigm, that I believe that we the people should demand that they institute this and give out a first and final for those deserving. Now, who would be deserving? The people that would be deserving are the people who asked, can we really do this? In other words, your saving grace is because you're kind of new to office and you go, hey, I don't think we have the authority to do what we're doing here by passing a digital currency bill. If you had any questions as a public servant, and you can prove, you need to be able to prove that you were very apprehensive in voting for that as a Democrat or as a Republican. It doesn't matter what your party is. This doesn't include party. This is about the Constitution and your legal obligation to support it. And if you have failed that by not supporting the Constitution, then you have failed we the people, and you have failed the citizens of the United States and the United States in its whole. Therefore, you are to be removed. And so when we have this, and I believe the implementation should just go out as, you know, if you have any evidence for, you know, this digital currency bill, and there's plenty of other things that you can put on the table, but you have to have at least evidence that you have really tried to do the right thing because you asked. If not, you're gone. But I believe those who actually brought the bills in, those who were the sponsors of the unconstitutional bills, those who were the speakers advocating for violating the Constitution, they're gone just like that. All those leaders, they're gone. Every judge that had ruled against the Constitution in supporting invaders, one way or the other, gone. The judges on the panel that may have been challenging and, you know, looking otherwise, you know, the new kids in office, whatever. I think we can extend to them a first and final. What that means, folks, if you've never heard the expression, first and final, it's your first and final warning. You pop in or you do something that pops into the status that you have violated your oath, you're gone. The next time you don't get a wave anymore, and all people moving forward, this is a hard standard. You come into office, you don't get a first and final anymore. We are only doing this as a one-time implementation. Does that make sense? And is that not fair?
I mean, it's absolutely fair.
Okay.
But if you're going to eliminate the entire, nobody's ever going to vote for that.
None of our electors will vote for that, but I'm telling you, what happens between now and the time we get constitutional people in? This is why we need people to sign pledges that I will support the Constitution moving forward because they've never signed a pledge before. They were a conservative, they were a Republican, but now I see that we will grant, you know, this first and final, and we're going to hold the line. We will now hold the line, and I want to run a campaign on being held accountable because I realize that you, the people, us folks, we have failed to hold them accountable. But now that we've realized that we can hold them accountable and that we demand them be accountable, then that's the kind of campaign they're going to have to run. And they're going to have to say, moving forward, we are going to demand everybody being held accountable. I think the whole blanket of giving everybody one big pass, forgiving all of their sins, no, that we can't do that. That's why I say, at a minimum, the people who brought the bills to the floor, the people who sponsored violations against the U.S. Constitution and state constitutions, but technically this is about the U.S. Constitution, we'll just focus it there. Anybody that has brought in bills, the digital currency is one of those. Another one of those bills is bringing in, you know, the laws or regulations that came in from the federal government that you actually had to stand up, you know, a system to basically align with Obamacare. Whoever brought those things in, whoever sponsored those things, they should be, you know, put into a banishment status. And as a matter of fact, a part of doing this, every state, the Secretary of State should legally be required to maintain that banishment list so that when a person moves from one state to the next, it can be easily ascertained as to whether that person is on the banishment list. Because this applies to every state in the union. You can't move from one state and get that banishment lifted from you. You might be able to hide in a county, but every person eventually will start going, hey, hold on here. We've got to check not only whether the person's a citizen and whether they're the right age, have they ever been banished? And so there should be, possibly, as a matter of fact, I think that this would give Congress the ability to create the National Registry of Banishment. This includes the military, folks. This includes the people who are operating in the Department of Justice. This includes people who are operating in offices that actually are unconstitutional. If you're operating in an office that is unconstitutional, then you should, and this is the hardest thing to do, you should actually leave. You should just basically say, you know what, I'm in, like the FBI, it's unconstitutional. So, or the ATF, unconstitutional. Those jobs and functions are for the militia. The Constitution is clear, only the militia can perform the execution of the laws. They're the only ones that can enforce the laws. Therefore, if you're in a role or responsibility or power that the federal government has assumed, then the smartest thing you could do is just step down. Just quit and go get a job at the local level. I mean, you can easily translate yourself, but once you start having the epiphany, I honestly see that there will be a resistance to people vacating these positions. There will be a resistance, but I honestly think that there's enough good people that will actually start doing this to say, you know what? I know that the position, the office, the department that I am working in, the Department of Education, is unconstitutional. And even though I am making money, you know, and I've got this supposedly unconstitutional retirement and benefits coming to me, they're going to realize that the faster they get out, the faster they get into another position, the more they will actually build a credibility of an actual retirement, if there's a retirement on the table. Does that make sense? Because the retirement that you're being promised, those people who've retired from the Department of Education and all these other unconstitutional departments, that's going to go away. And so the states are going to inherit a lot of people that will probably be destitute. I honestly think, you know, you hear people say that America needs to turn back towards him. America needs to find Christ. And America needs to get righteous and get right with God again. Right? Get right with God, folks. Get right with God. So I am here to tell you that America will be in a situation where we will have to get right with God as, you know, as not just an individual, but as a community, because there's going to be people around that are going to have, they're going to be destitute. They're not going to get, they were lied to. They went into a position, they didn't do the due diligence on their own and say, you know what, this position is not legitimate. They were told it was legitimate, but that, you know, and all the smoke and mirrors proved that it was for years and years it operated. Look at that. But the reality sinks in. So I think that America will really have its challenges as it gets right, or as it aligns to its true constitutional constructs. But think about it, folks. Are we really, because if either we get right with the Constitution, or we're going to be engulfed in this new age globalism, because what we thought the progressive globalism was is not the globalism that we're probably going to be pulled into, but it's going to still be the evil globalism of the abomination. And I say that because a lot of people today are saying, hey, Trump is just dismantling this whole apparatus of the globalists. No, he's just rewiring it. He's rewiring it so that it is no longer this, what would seem impalatable. You got to remember that the scriptures basically say that, you know, we all get deceived because it's at least a good form of evil. Right? We can accept good evil. We can't accept bad evil. And good evil is, you know, evil that recognizes the family and the relationships of the family and all things that we, you know, we know that are right. In other words, the nine truths to basically get us into believing the tenth lie, or the one lie of the ten, right? And so I think that that's the direction. I never saw American fall into the arms of globalism in the dark evil, or the, you know, the evil evil. It was going to fall into the arms of the good evil, because we're basically good people. So we have to be concocted into believing that there is a good, you know, this good side is good, when actually it's just good evil, if that makes any sense. So,
yeah.
All right. Great. So let's dive into the next part of the 14th Amendment. And folks, I hope, did the way I dissect that really help? If I rewrote that, if I actually said this is what the language really, to clarify what it's trying to do here, to simplify it, there you go. Because the confusion...
Rewrite it and put it underneath.
Yeah, so the confusing part is why did they have to go through and list who this is qualified? You know, who falls under this standard, this new standard that the Constitution created? And so by listing it twice, I don't know, sometimes people like to just make it, long and wordy, and I'm guilty of that myself. I try to, in my writing, most people, I actually try to cover meat, and I throw meat on the plate here. I just don't do fluffy, I'm not the guy that stands up and says, ain't I great? This is great. I mean, you're great, I'm great, we're all great, and this is just great, isn't it? And what I just said was really nothing. But I made myself feel better and you feel better. But I said really nothing. Anyway. Anywho, let's dive into the fourth section. Now, this section, folks, is the real reason why Britain went into full-on attack mode politically. Why they started pouring more money into American politics than they have ever done before. Here you go. Go ahead.
Okay. The validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave. But all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void.
Okay, so... do you understand why this really alarmed the global empire? Do you understand why? It says right here in the red part, neither the United States nor any state shall assume. So any state, if you're a part of the United States, you are no longer obligated to pay any debt that supported the insurrection against the Constitution. So, nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States. So, when the southern states ratify and come back into the Union, this part of this amendment wipes out their obligations, because the obligations were done to the Confederation. The Southern Confederation that was created, it was the Southern Confederation that owed that debt, and these states were a part of that. And when they left that Confederation to join the Union, now they qualified as a state in the Union. And in other words, the wiping out of the Confederation and the assuming or the consuming of all of the former states back in, or admitting all the former states back in, once qualified by Congress to come back into the Union, then the debt went away. Do you think that you would just let that just happen? If you found out that, you had a legitimate debt with this new entity, and then all of a sudden that entity just got, you were spending more and more money in supporting. There was a huge risk with this. I mean, the states could have actually claimed bankruptcy or what have you. And then what? Britain was going to come foreclose and take these states back because their obligations and so forth? This part of the Constitution was literally a swipe at that contract and that legal obligation of paying Britain for helping them defend themselves against the North. You got to remember that they were winning the war for 2 years. It seemed like a good investment. And then Britain had to spend more and more and more money in trying to basically... It's like, is the United States obligated to pay back the people that were funding an attack against them, regardless of whether they were agents, former states in the Union that have come back or not. The United States cannot be legally obligated to pay that debt. And they wanted to make sure they put it in hardcore supreme law writing. There it is. We are not going to be held. And that debt is void as far as we're concerned. That was such an alarm. This is why the radical Republicans by 1870 were ousted. Enough of them were ousted to where those who were under the control of the British government actually started doing things to try to attack and marginalize the 14th Amendment. This is why the 14th Amendment was in a status for a period of time of whether it was ratified or not. This is why they were doing everything they could to keep this amendment from actually, becoming so legitimate that they couldn't undo it. And they realized that they couldn't undo it. There was no mechanism to actually allow them to really undo this, other than by creating these false narratives that it wasn't properly ratified. There may have been questions to whether states could unratify it, but that was quickly resolved. There was nothing in there that, granted the state once ratified, that they could unratify it. The only way that that could actually be then acceptable is for the United States to accept a state coming back and saying, hey, we ratified it, but we want to undo that. And that precedence was set by the radical Republicans saying, no, you can't unratify this amendment, because three states tried to do it. So their hands were so tied in concrete, their feet were bound in concrete. There was nothing that these anti-14th Amendment people could do. So the wave of attacks that ascended upon the 14th Amendment in the 1870s was the Supreme Court started redefining every part of the 14th Amendment by first starting and attacking the equal protection under the law, equally attacking the privileges and immunities of U.S. citizens, equally attacking the citizenship later on by basically disavowing the fact that a person could become a citizen, that a black person could be a citizen, so forth and so on. So they attacked this 14th Amendment and redefined it. This is why, the way they've redefined, this is why so many people hate the 14th Amendment. But don't hate the 14th Amendment. You got to hate the people that were redefining it. And guess who that was? That was the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, once again, acted as the oligarchy of gods and basically took the law and completely perverted it. And there goes the show. Thank you so much for joining us, Tammy. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
And so when we come back tomorrow, we will dive into the 15th Amendment. And then we should actually cruise through the next few amendments pretty quickly. The 16th Amendment, I know, follows, which is the Progressive Amendment. But there's no there, just like to the 17th Amendment. There's no boogeyman in those amendments. We'll quickly go through that. And we should hopefully, with maybe in a week or so, be done with all of the amendments. I'm Jerry Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.